Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, have you been involved in any clinches over the course of lockdown?
Am I meant to know what a clinch is?
Yes, you are supposed to know what a clinch is. It relates to one of our new stories that we've picked.
A clinch?
A clinch. Do you want to guess?
You're gonna have to help me, mate. What's a clinch?
So I'll give you a hint. Matt Hancock was recently involved in a clinch.
Is it having an extramarital affair? That breaches lockdown rules and then is caught on camera.
It's not that specific, but I mean, the affair wasn't caught on camera. I think we should say just, you know, an aspect of it. It's not as though the whole tryst is available.
I don't think anyone wanted that image put in their head. Jimmy, thank you very much.
So a clinch is an amorous embrace, according to Google. The image of Matt Hancock, the now former health secretary, hugging and kissing Gina.
And groping the arse of. Clinching, I guess. The arse off. Do you clinch an arse?
I don't know. The clinch is basically a hug. It's like, it's a smoochy hug. Basically,
it's a smoochy hug.
I brought this up because the word, I don't know if you've noticed this, but sometimes a particular word is used to describe something, like in sort of news stories. Remember when Jeremy Clarkson was caught in a fracas when mm-hmm. he punched that producer,
the
in
Irish
the face.
Guy, yeah,
yeah. And no one previously had really been aware of the word fracas, and I think people haven't really used it since. But in this case, with the Matt Hancock story, clinch appears to be the word that
not seen that used as a way to describe it anywhere.
I'm shocked. Maybe this is just the editor in me thinking, why have they used that word? Nobody uses that word.
I think so, probably, yeah. I was mainly too horrified washing my eyes out with bleach after seeing the video. he kisses like, I mean, it would be an insult to 14-year-old boys to suggest that he kisses like a 14-year-old boy. Like, it was literally all mouth.
Is there a video? I thought it was just pictures.
Yeah, no. Full video, my friend. It's CCTV.
I didn't realise the video was available, I thought.
Oh, you... Well, this is one of the many privileges that you have of not being on Twitter.
I see. Mm. Okay, so...
It was just at the top of every fucking feed. You couldn't get away from it. It actually did quite ruin my weekend.
Well, we're going to allow you to relive some of those memories as we discuss.
Glorious.
Matt Hancock, who is now, as of Sunday, he's resigned and been replaced by Sajid Javid. So, and it's a very classic sort of sleazy scandal, actually.
But everybody seems to be trying to pretend that it isn't and saying that, he broke lockdown rules. That's not, I mean, that's by the by, isn't it? He gave a job to the girl he was bonking and got caught on video. And he's a married man with little ones.
Yeah, more on this later.
But we're not meant to think about that. That's because that's his private life.
Indeed. Jazza, what else are we going to be talking about before you spill any more beans on the Hancock story?
We'll also be talking about the launch of GB News, which I think is Jimmy's way of us sandwiching in another Tom Harwood story, because it's been a while, hasn't it? Tom Harwood, the political correspondent for GB News, whatever the fuck that means, was launched last week, and I mean, the schadenfreude is going to come through in my voice, isn't it? It's going very badly. There have been so many examples of just technical ineptitude in the broadcast. The set looks like somebody's garage that they have dressed up. I know YouTubers with one-man teams that seem to understand how broadcast works better than the people that they've hired for GB News. And Andrew Neil, who was meant to be the figurehead of this new supposedly anti-woke, anti-social justice, we connect with the people, we'll talk about things that you care about, was basically meant to be the Fox News of the UK. He is going on holiday, apparently, for a few weeks, which probably doesn't bode very well for the channel either. Have you watched any?
I've watched several clips in preparation for this, all via the YouTube channel, actually. So I suppose I've seen the most flattering cuts of GB News, but...
Yeah, isn't it sad that even the most flattering cuts are really bad?
I don't know. I mean, I think some of the clips are kind of interesting. I saw an interview with Roger Hallam, who is one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion, which I thought was quite interesting, if not... Not entirely good from his point of view. I think Andrew Neil gave him a pretty hard time. But we could talk about the technical difficulties, you know, where it sits in the media landscape, which is the sort of topic we love. We can also talk about the attempts to force advertisers or, you know, convince advertisers to boycott it, which have
A lot of advertisers have decided to pull out anyway, haven't they? Regardless of certainly campaigns that are being run to get them to pull out. Like Vodafone, Specsavers, Boots have all pulled advertising from GB News, which is quite significant because even though it's got £60 million worth of backing, I believe, they are meant to be completely reliant on advertising for their revenue. And if advertisers don't want to advertise there, and advertising does tend to be a pretty woke part of our kind of like economy. They seem to be very skittish around being associated with nasty views. Is that the best word I could have come up with?
The way I heard it phrased by one unsympathetic columnist was, you know, a channel that doesn't fully embrace diversity and inclusion. But I mean, it's worth saying that the likes of Google and Amazon and Microsoft are still advertising with GB News, so I don't think it's going entirely badly for them. But we'll get more into the details later, and we can discuss Tom Holwood more if you really want to, Jazza. I'm not going to prevent you from doing that.
Thank you.
What's the last topic we've got here, Jazza?
So there was a report released by the government around. It was called The Forgotten, How White Working Class Pupils Have Been Let Down and How to Change It. And basically they found that, and these are statistics that we've kind of known for a while. We found that it's been found that white British pupils are the least likely to achieve good grades and then go on to university.
These are pupils on free school meals.
Free school meals, white working class children. The only demographics that are less likely than them are Gypsy, Roma, and Irish and Irish heritage traveller of Irish heritage pupils. Are meant to do worse. The weird, the statistics about this have already existed, but this report chose to say that it was because of social justice.
I think that's a minor point. At least it was a minor point in the introduction
The writers of the report went on shows and then talked at length about it being social justice is a bad thing for these pupils, which is a very odd stance to take from a government that has removed things like Sure Start.
So it's worth saying this isn't actually a government report. It's an Education Select Committee report. So it's actually an adjunct from the government, I would say.
Thank you for correcting me.
But it does fit into, as you say, I think it's fair to say there is a strain of anti-wokeness in the government's agenda. And this does,
I mean,
this report
I'm,
does
I'm
fit
shocked,
into
shocked, are you not?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure we could get into a, you know, heated argument about this.
Trying to create a culture war? The Conservative government? Never.
Never, 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 never. All right, Jazza, shall we play some music, talk about the Patreon accounts, and get on with the main part of the show?
You know what? I think we shall, actually, Jimmy. Thank you very much for suggesting that.
Good stuff.
Hello, friends, it's Jazza here. I'm editing the podcast this week, which is why it's a little bit late. My apologies. But I just wanted to remind you that we, as an independent, crowd-funded podcast, need your support in order to keep on making these episodes. We have a Patreon where you can donate as little as £1 an episode. If you think we're worth £1, then why not go over to Patreon, search for The Right Dishonourable in there. Thank you so much already to our Patreon supporters who are currently already backing us. Alexander, David, Andrew, Michael, John, Matt, and Gemma. Thank you so much. You really help us to, not be out of pocket by making this podcast. Appreciate you. Now on with the show. Jimmy, are you surprised at all that it took an incredibly embarrassing video to be leaked to the papers and then plastered all over the internet of Matt Hancock smooching and doing a bit of bum fundling of his colleague for him to be fired, rather than incompetence when it came to handling of the pandemic? An opinion held apparently not only by the likes of you and I, but also by his own boss, the Prime Minister, in texts leaked by the former aide, Dominic Cummings.
Just remind me what the Dominic Cummings leaked to test, and was it Boris Johnson called him fucking hopeless?
Yeah, fucking hopeless. Hopeless. And then also the Queen called him a poor man. Do you remember that last week?
I do vaguely remember that, yeah.
She's a very, if you're pro monarchy or not, that lady, she's very astute, isn't she?
Well, I imagine during the course of her reign, she's seen a lot of poor men doing jobs they weren't really qualified or fit to do.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything, her, her cool demeanour in the face of such uselessness or hopelessness is quite something.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I sort of thought that this was a bit of a Teflon government, in the sense that
no one was ever going to quit for anything, because we had
kind of
Priti Patel has broken the ministerial code for bullying her staff. She stayed. Matt Hancock's just been absolutely appalling at his job. They've lied about the Irish border down the border down the Irish Sea. And Boris Johnson exists. They're not very good at their jobs, are they? This is the thing that I can't really wrap my head around. And this is something that Dominic Cummings actually said when he did his testimony a few weeks ago. I can't believe that in a country of 65 million people, these were the ones that ended up running the fucking thing.
I mean, can you really not believe that?
It's the
system, isn't it? Like,
it is. Yeah, 100%. But it's just, I think it's important every now and again that we take a step back and realise how fucking terrible it is. Like, I cannot believe, and you know what? This is a personal affront to me. Because
in what way?
I didn't have sex for such a long time that I, as a single gay man, was then able to give blood. And this whole time, Matt fucking Hancock was having some on the side in Whitehall at his offices. I had to buy myself a sex toy.
Is the evidence that he actually had sexy times in the office? I don't know if that bit has been confirmed.
I really do not care about the minutiae of the details, to be completely honest.
I'm just
anyone
saying,
who's,
you know,
listening, like, to this and wants to, and decides to sue us, go on, sue me.
I don't think there's any
leave
risk of
that. Leave Jimmy out of this.
I think there was, I was reading a report somewhere that he'd taken, I don't think we said her name, Anna, Gina Colin D'Angelo. I'm probably not saying that right. You're looking at me despairingly, Dan.
I'm just going to assume that you said it incorrectly, and then I'm not going to say her name either, because I don't know how it's pronounced either.
But I think the evidence is that there was a report that she and him went to a G7 summit or something like that, and that they stayed in the same hotel room together.
Lovely. They also went to uni together.
They did. So they go way back. They go She's way actually back. Friends with is it Martha Hancock, who's Matt's now soon-to-be former wife.
Mm, that's... What terrible people. I'm so, that's the only conclusion that I have. What terrible, terrible people these are. Also, her brother, apparently, runs a supplier to the NHS.
Well, I think we've covered the, you know, the crony procurement deals that have gone on previously in the podcast, so...
I think that we should bring them up again to highlight once again how fucking incompetent and evil it is. Like, I don't like to partake in any of the, oh, Tories are a four-letter word and never fuck a Tory, blah, 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 all of that stuff. I'd happily fuck a Tory. I'd fuck anything that stood still long enough and consented. But...
Especially after the long
after the drought that was 2020. Thank you very much. But I this government is just so bad, but everybody fucking voted for them, and I don't know how to fix that other than, I don't know, make everybody listen to this podcast. I don't know how we fix this. I don't know how we fix this, because these were the people that we decided to run things. Of course it was going to go badly, and we were going to have... There was going to be shits like this, because they're all in it, because everything is sex except sex, which is power. So they all want power so they can all have sex with their friend, with their wife's friend, who they went to uni with.
I think this is an interesting Freudian theory of why people get into politics.
Oh, it's 100% why. It's they couldn't be famous any other way because they were ugly, so they got into politics. That's a well-known trope, isn't it?
Show business for ugly people, yeah. As the phrase goes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think the interesting thing about the Hancock story, particularly the affair thing, is that I was at the pub yesterday and there were people... You know, friends of mine who usually don't take much interest in politics, but this story had like amazing cut through.
Yeah,
with people,
it's because of that image in that video, right? Like, it's...
Well, I think affairs are just like, people love gossip, don't they?
Ah, sure. Yeah.
And affairs are just much more...
And Love Island isn't on yet, so.
Yeah. Affairs are much more innately interesting to people than procurement scandals, mm-hmm. Which are. Often take a while to explain, and even in the explaining are quite dull, and there's usually financial details and all the rest of it. It is just quite dull. I mean, I was still kind of surprised that he resigned, because I mean, one thing that's interesting in this is that the 10 Downing Street has explicitly stated to the press that they didn't want Matt Hancock to go. I mean, how absolutely true that is.
Yeah, the,
I don't know,
the Prime Minister considered the issue closed after Matt Hancock apologised.
I mean, obviously, Boris Johnson can't sack somebody for having an affair, given his own track record.
I mean, right.
So, and you know, obviously, with the whole Jennifer Arcuri story, she definitely got some government benefits from having a close friendship with Boris Johnson. I'd even forgotten about her during his time as mayor. Yeah.
My God.
Well, that story kept propping up again and again and again, with, you know, slightly more details.
But the thing
and then
is,
just kept sinking.
And I've noticed this a little bit with the covering of the Hancock story and subsequent resignation. That I feel like a lot of the media feel like it isn't proper to talk about the affair bit. Like, they seem to be... The main thing that seems to be the thing that they're talking about all of the time is the fact that he broke lockdown rules. That's not really kind of like the...
So part of the reason for that, as I understand it anyway, and I was
go on, speak for your people. Your people being journalists.
I was listening to the Spectator coverage of this story earlier today, and Fraser Nelson repeatedly made the point that it's much, basically because of since the Leveson inquiry, it's much harder to just break like a straightforward sex scandal story, even if there's an affair involved and infidelity involved, because the newspapers are much more twitchy about like publishing something like that, because mm-hmm. they're afraid they'll be sued for invasion of privacy and that sort of thing. However, if you can find a public interest hook, such as, you know, hypocrisy in mm-hmm. terms of like he made all these, you know, social distancing rules and then broke them, then you can break the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, in reality, I think people probably in this story find the affair aspect The salacious kind of aspect, the most interesting part of it, and the social distancing thing is slightly tagged on. But I suppose in counter to that, there was nothing particularly salacious about the Dominic Cummings scandal from his trip to Barnard Castle. Like, there was nothing sordid about it. But I suppose with that, the detail that everybody remembers is the eye test thing, is that mm-hmm. him having gone for a drive to check his eyes.
Ended up being my most successful tweet of the past year. I drove up to Newcastle, saw the sign for Barnard Castle, and was like, I can't not go. So turned off the A1 straight for Barnard Castle, and then took a photo in front of it saying that, oh, I've driven here to test my eyesight. People loved it. Twitter went wild.
There you go. That's some viral content marketing tip mm-hmm. from Jazza there.
Seize your opportunities.
Very much so. I think the thing is, even though like newspapers are much less prone to covering these scandals than they used to be. I mean, a lot of people have said back in like the 90s, if you just caught a politician with his trousers down, that was basically a story in pretty much any context. And now that's not really so much the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to have been a post Leveson inquiry thing as to why that is. But the public still like the stories, I think. I mean,
of course. And like I said, Love Island isn't on yet. There is the kind of like side story of how this footage was found, both the image that went around on the newspapers and the video that went around the internet. Nobody seems really to be sure where it came from. There's suggestion that it's CCTV inside the Department of Health. Some other people are suggesting that it may have been a hidden camera and that it got leaked by a... I heard on the MAR program this morning, they were talking about it being leaked by a disgruntled... somebody who disagreed with lockdowns.
Right.
which seems a bit odd, really, for it to have surfaced now. But, do you think it... How worrying is it that videos from inside the government can be leaked so easily?
I mean, it's not that surprising. Everybody walks around with a video camera on them these days. Mm. So, you know, if you... I mean, obviously in this case, somebody didn't just like leave their smartphone recording in the background, but, you know, it's given the state of like information technology. Yeah, sure. Like you can get footage and images of stuff like that. I mean, the insinuation that there was a sort of secret camera planted. I think I read somewhere, this is probably rubbish, but I read somewhere that it was like put near to like a fire alarm or something like that. And there seems to be a theory that it was a sort of security contractor working like, so a private sector employee working with on a public sector contract that leaked it. I mean, I think the variety of the theories probably just suggests that nobody really knows.
No one really knows, yeah. That Sun just got, it got leaked to the Sun, and then kaboom, there we go.
I think it's sort of, I mean, some people, I think, particularly Tories who are interested in moving the scandal on to a slightly different topic, have suggested there should be a security inquiry into how this was able to happen. I sort of think it doesn't really matter in a way. Like, if you do something slightly sneaky and outside of the rules in an attempt to whistleblow, which is what this effectively is, it's a whistleblowing story, it sort of doesn't really matter, I don't think. Mm. And I think the thing is, if somebody has access to a government building and they have the ability to plant a camera somewhere, I don't entirely know what like is going to stop that ultimately. I mean, you're never going to reduce the risk of that to zero, I don't think. Mm. Particularly if the person's in a role where, you know, it's not going to be unusual for them to be seen checking things in old places, basically. I don't know. I sort of think it's a distraction tactic to some degree.
Oh yeah, 100%. I agree. Like, I think there should broadly be, I think we should be a little bit worried, because then if Whitehall isn't, like, those are meant to be doors behind which people can, I guess, speak freely and do their jobs and kiss the staff. But if there aren't kind of like those spaces for professionals, then where the people running the country, then where is safe? I don't know. Maybe it suggests that Russia are listening into everything and always have been.
I don't know if there's I think it's that film about the kind of decision to kill Osama bin Laden. Mm. It's a kind of dramatization of it, and I think I haven't seen the film, but I believe that they all have to put their smartphones in a box basically away from the like conference room where that final decision takes place. Mm. With the president and his advisors. So I mean, that's sort of the thing, like in everyone's walking around with eminently hackable devices in their pocket all of the time. I think you should probably, whatever building you're in, you should assume that there is some risk of the information being leaked. Mm. And, you know, this is, apart from anything else in politics, your political enemies will always have an incentive to leak unpleasant information about you. And this is quite a leaky government, mm, as it goes, given all the factional infighting. So
what do you know. Think? Do you think we'll ever see anything more of Mr. Hancock?
I've read somebody said that he'll be back in the cabinet by the end of the year, which seems
I'd be
ridiculous.
Really surprised.
Yeah, that seems optimistic to me. I mean, it is noteworthy that Sajid Javid, his replacement as health secretary, was apparently out of cabinet for 18 months because he was previously the chancellor and then, mm-hmm, was sacked.
He left because he wouldn't let a cabinet office appoint advisors to the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yes.
So he wanted to pick his own
right.
advisors, but Dominic Cummings, I believe, was the block there, wouldn't let him. So he said any self-respecting minister wouldn't agree to those terms, and then Rishi Sunak got the job and clearly agreed to those terms.
Well, he did say self-respecting.
So. Yeah, fair.
But I mean, a lot of people have said, oh, well, in these kind of scenarios, you have to like resign quickly and essentially try and get out of the blast radius of the scandal as soon as possible, just to limit damage to yourself, and then you can come back. And I guess there's lots of examples of ministers who've done just that and ended up with other jobs in other scenarios. But I think the point you raised actually at the start of this about competence to do the job, which is really the reason that the main reason any minister should be sacked. I mean, I think it's...
Are they ever, though?
Not really, I guess. Like, and I think it's sort of a problem in the way our government is designed, is that you sort of get the impression that, like, a lot of these ministers aren't really... I know it's kind of inherent in the system that they don't necessarily have a lot of subject knowledge and they just have to be briefed by their, you know, civil servants and whatnot. But I don't know. I sort of got the impression that Dominic Cummings gives is that a lot of ministers who really didn't know dick about pandemics were just like running around trying to design like procurement systems or track and trace. Or I know they weren't the only people involved in that. There were civil servants and other more technical people involved. But it's... The system like clearly doesn't work on some basic grounds, and that's not going to change just because Matt Hancock has been sacked. Maybe
what?
There needs to be a clearer delineation of what counts as like a political decision, such as, you know, the economic trade-offs of going into lockdown versus more technical work, which really should be the matter for expertise. But
yeah, how depressing.
Yep. Very much.
Anyway,
so.
Shall we talk about GB News? Because that will perk us up a little bit.
Yeah.
The Schadenfreude is strong.
Okay, so you're clearly quite happy at how badly it's been going for GB News.
Yeah.
So what? explain your feelings behind that, Jezza. Like, what's going on? Delve into your psyche for a moment.
So I read in Private Eye the suggestion that they had spent so much of their money on the on-screen talent that they had skimped on and hadn't offered competitive enough wages for the people who would be producing it, all of the techies, etc. So they had to rely on people who believed in the cause of GB News, of trying to unwokeify the media landscape, the televised media landscape. And it turns out they aren't being thinking that deplatforming is the greatest risk to freedom of speech in our country does not mean that you're good at broadcast journalism. It really is the incompetence of kind of like from the technical side that I've enjoyed the most, I think. The fact that mics aren't on, that journalists in the field don't know how to frame shots properly, or are too far away from their mics so you can't hear them. The fact that Andrew Neil's opening speech, his opening monologue, was done on what looked like an IKEA desk. Like, it's all... like, it's such an absolute mess. And you'd think with 60 million quid worth, 60 million quid of investment behind them, they'd be able to actually get a desk that did that meant that you couldn't see Andrew Neil's socks. But you could. And frankly, there is, like, the wider conversation around them trying to shift broadcast journalism to the right. They kind of the offering that they have is much more pundit-y. It's much more like the likes of Fox News, for example.
So I think actually the shifting it to the right for me is like less of an issue. I mean, there are definitely like left-wing people I know who are basically just upset that there's a right-wing, there's a more right-wing like news channel. Because I mean, people always argue about the BBC and like where it sits. But the likes of something like Channel 4, I think Channel 4 is quite openly like left wing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I would agree with you.
I think it's ridiculous to argue. And to have like another channel that's
Does
on the right.
Does anybody have an opinion on ITV News though? That's a great question.
I try to avoid ITV News.
I don't think I've ever watched it.
I mean, I don't really watch broadcast like TV journalism. So in some ways, I'm just not really the target market for this. But I don't think there's a problem with having a right-wing broadcaster, like centre-right at least. I think that's okay.
You read The Spectator, so you'd say that.
Yeah, but like I'm saying that if you've got a slight, you know, a centre-left broadcaster having a centre-right one, in theory, I think is okay. And I don't think it really breaches the overall Ofcom kind of, maybe not strict rules, but like the sense that broadcasting should be kind of balanced in a way. I think if you really are upset by a broadcaster having a political stance, you should also think that Channel 4 needs to clean up its act as well. I guess that's all I would say.
The thing is, Channel 4 News reports on the news, like breaks news, does actual reporting, whereas GB News doesn't really seem to have any desire to do that. It just seems to be like the video feed of what Guido Fawkes would be.
Well, a lot of it is basically just like comment stuff. I mean, it's sort of it kind of sits in the same mold as this podcast, I suppose. There's no original reporting. It's just reacting to the news. But I think that...
Are we part of the problem? Well, so I've had two reactions to that. One, are we part of the problem? Two, where's our £60 million?
I just don't think there's an audience basically. Yeah. I don't think our analysis is that much less well informed than some of the stuff I've seen on GB.
That's actually a fair point.
No offense to Tom Howard and friends.
Oh, I'd like to make sure that anyone listening knows that we do mean offense.
But you've sort of alluded to it already, but the much more interesting thing about GB News is that the kind of presenters openly opine on subjects. So one thing I will say about Channel 4 News is I do think that they at least cleave to the idea that presenters are just there to ask questions and not there to take a view. But on GB News, you know, it's very opinionated. You know, all of the presenters... I was watching an interview about... the Derek Chauvin conviction, so the killer of George Floyd has just got 22 years, and it was reaction to that. And the news reader was openly giving her views on things.
Ooh, what were they?
You know, I sort of can't remember. I don't think they're that interesting. She was interviewing a black British policeman and kind of getting his reaction, and she was kind of chipping in with her own comments, basically. Which I think the wider fear is that British television will turn into something more like the American model, which you've already mentioned, and a lot of people have described GB News as like Fox TV UK edition. Confusingly, Rupert Murdoch was reported to be interested in launching a Fox TV for the UK, but then
wasn't that going to be called UK News?
I don't know, but it
something
collapsed
like
quite abruptly. Like there was a bit of chatter around it when GB News was announced, and then in the last month or two, it just like there wasn't very much going on. It was like, oh, this isn't happening anymore, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, there probably wasn't enough space enough for the two of them, I don't think. So it kind of makes sense. But yeah, some of the content is on GB News is interesting, is enjoyable.
Oh, go on, give us an interesting piece of content.
I think I mentioned it in the intro, but the Roger Hallam interview, like Extinction Rebellion co-founder. I thought that was actually kind of in the same style as Andrew Neil's interviews on the BBC, basically, where he just sort of interrogates and takes somebody apart. And I personally find those kind of interviews very interesting, where the word forensic, I guess, might be used to describe them in a sort of Keir Starmer-esque manner. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that, I think, is quite good. I mean, there was a panel discussion with again your friend Tom.
My friend Tom Harwood.
Talking about the delaying of lockdown restrictions easing from the 21st of June to whenever it is in July. Mm. That was kind of interesting.
What did they say?
I think generally speaking, they were just upset. I mean, Tom was upset that he had to get a refund for some nightclub tickets. So, for example, so I found that amusing. Jazza is looking utterly aghast.
Can I just say, I very easily got a refund for mine, so.
That's what
the UK media landscape has been gagging for, isn't it? Tom Harwood being annoyed that his nightclub tickets aren't going to be valid anymore. For goodness sake. says the guy with the podcast.
I mean, I think it's... The thing is, I sort of don't get the TV play in general, like, because I don't watch... To be fair, TV news is the most widely sort of watched news. We tend to, like, focus on print journalism here, and that does drive the news agenda. Mm. Most people consume their news, or at least a plurality of them do, via television broadcasting. So in that sense, it's a big market. But I just feel like... I mean, this is very much like a millennial perspective, but, like... Who the fuck watches TV news? Do you know what I mean? Like
the over 75s. Everybody else is watching streaming or Navarra Media.
Yeah, well, I guess you can. I mean, I'm sure you can stream GB News somewhere, but I just don't. I don't really 24-hour rolling TV coverage. I find quite boring, and I mean. Obviously, a lot of people disagree with me because, you know, these channels do exist and people watch them. But I can't... It's an odd play from my point of view because I can't see that people... You know, as young people get older, will they increasingly start turning on their TVs and watching news that way? If they do, then GB News will be okay. And if they don't, then I don't really see how much of a future it has long term. But
you can... You can... watch GB News live on their website, gbnews.uk. And Tom Harwood has two of the top five stories, so that's lovely.
There you go. So they are actually reporting news. I don't think they've...
Hancock's gone. What next? GB News. GB News submit freedom of information to the Department of Health. Great.
I've got to say, I think sending an FOI request is not a news story.
Apparently, it is.
That's like me saying, oh, I sent an email to some guy to ask about like this thing, and then writing that up as a news story.
That is what has happened.
I think that's quite a poor show. But to your light point about all the technical problems, I think they will sort those out in the coming weeks. It is obviously very embarrassing initially, but I think they'll fix them. Do you not? Like these are kind of teething issues.
I don't know. Like there's only so much that you can. They need new lights as well. In that, like it's a very poorly lit. Very often, recording this kind of stuff will happen in a basement because of the sound quality. Mm. But GB News looks like it's been shot in a basement. and I don't know. I'm sure that they will. These people that they've hired will learn on the job, and so the only way is up, really, because up until now it's been quite embarrassing. I reckon I could do a better job, but then I think about that in when I look at most things, to be honest, that's because I'm getting older and grumpier. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's got legs. I don't think it will last the year.
Interesting. So put aside your own, you know. So...
And also, nobody's watching it. That's kind of like the main thing, right? It is a very, very long way the least watched news broadcast in the country.
Its initial ratings were good, though, weren't they, for opening? Like the first night, I think it...
Well, yeah, because it was people like you, me, and everybody else who wanted to see it. And then went, oh dear.
So you're saying its ratings are massively down since then? It's kind of...
They are.
The
I did see... I did see somewhere where they're in the low tens of thousands of people are watching shows at the
and
moment.
And by comparison, Sky regularly gets more than 100,000 views.
Something like that. Yeah.
We really should have looked at these stats. But let's sure. just say it's not good. But
yeah, but we don't have to put in the amount of research that GB News does.
We don't, no. So no. Set aside your own like misgivings about like the technical abilities of the channel and whatnot.
Mm.
Do you think it's a good thing that somebody has launched a right of centre kind of views led news channel? Is that a good thing for the British media landscape?
Do I think it's a good thing that they've created an LBC for the news?
Well, for TV no. as well, I guess.
For TV, the media in the UK in general, when we take into consideration broadcast in general, leans a little bit left, people would usually say, or at least centre ground. Right?
Yeah.
Our print media is skewed heavily right wing. Our radio media skews right wing. Our media landscape needed something else on the right.
Yeah.
And
no,
also,
I
just
that.
Don't think
yeah.
that I don't, I just don't, why are you launching a TV news channel?
Mm.
Like in 2021, for goodness sake, what is the, like, what kind of forward thinking is that?
Well, in the same way that the Times has recently launched a radio station, which also right. seems kind of odd in the age of the podcast, although maybe we would say that as podcasters.
Well, it's used as a way to be able to create a load of podcast content.
I guess that's true, yeah.
They basically clip everything from the radio.
Yeah, that's what the people want. They want on-demand content, don't they, Jazza? Like this here podcast.
Exactly. Look at us pioneers.
Let's see if we outlast GB News. I mean, we've been going 5 years at this stage, so I think we can probably do it.
I'm pretty sure we'll be fine. I think we can win that.
Got low operating costs, I think, is the key.
Although if anybody does want to thinks that we deserve something close to 60 million funding, then you can always go to our Patreon account.
This is true. We didn't actually, I think we touched on it in the intro, but we haven't covered the boycott, the attempted boycott. So let's just run through that quickly. So was it Stop Funding Hate was the kind of organisation, Stop Funding Hate and Ripples.
Stop Funding Hate and Boycott GB News.
Oh, so there's a specific Boycott GB News. So several campaigning groups have been contacting advertisers and asking them not to advertise on the channel. Ripples claims that GB News is spreading fake news, quote unquote. And Stop Funding Hate essentially will just target most right of centre publications, I think it's fair to say. Because they consider them poisonous for our media landscape, spreading bad views, basically, which is obviously something that we would know nothing about on this podcast.
I think it's more inaccurate news is the point, right? Because it's fake news. And divisive, and it's bad for society, etc.
I think there's a mix. Like Ripples seems to have gone with the fake news angle, whereas Stop Funding Hate is about stopping stories that will encourage bigotry in some way. That's their main thing.
Sure.
But it is. I mean, inevitably, it tends to be right wing organisations that are targeted for this. I suppose it won't surprise you, Jazza, that I'm not really sure this is it's a good thing to be trying to cut off the funding of organisations whose politics you disapprove of.
Uh-huh.
Like I'm not.
But you have quite curious attitudes when it comes to boycotts.
Go on, then.
Because you don't like them. As if we as consumers don't have a right to choose where we put our money in a capitalist system like
well,
this.
Well, I believe you have the right, but there's a lot of things I think you have the right to do that I don't think you should do because it's ill-advised.
I'm going to decide like where I put my money as a consumer and where I put my and when I am the thing being sold when I watch media, for example, where I put my eyeballs and where like I'm adding value to something. Like of course I'm going to do that, whether it's deciding not to read news on particular news websites because I don't want to give those news websites money, or choosing to not buy stuff from a particular country, etc. I think it is like those kinds of boycotts have always existed in some way, shape, or form, and I think they're a healthy part of democracy. Private Eye were very funny in pointing out that boycott GB News. Is calling for advertisers, among others, Amazon, to pull their advertising from GB News. And the website of boycottgbnews.org is hosted, guess who it's hosted by?
Amazon Web Services.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think actually probably says more about the lack of competition in the web services industry.
I don't think any of our anything that we do on the Right to Normal is related to Amazon Web Services. I don't think we can
say that with confidence. Jimmy, are we completely
honest? Well, we're hosted by name.com is the website, and Blueberry is the. But I may find out that one of those is owned by Amazon or leverages Amazon
possible.
Web Services in some capacity. So you're probably right, but we don't have any direct links to them. But I don't know. I think particularly in the case of this concept of the free press, which I know is often derided, but a press that is independent of what government wants somebody to publish, I think is quite important. And the only way that that has ever worked is if the press can rely on funding from advertisers or subscriptions or, you know, some source of income that is separate from, you know, government grants and whatnot. And
do you think the Telegraph is particularly good at holding the government to account?
No, I don't. No, but
Interesting.
But it's important in a democracy for people to be able to publish views that I don't like, just as it's important that people are able to publish views that Stop Funding Hate doesn't like.
Sure. I don't think that GB News shouldn't be allowed to exist, but I think that, I mean, it's clearly not going to have most of the impact that it's had has been people saying how shit it is. So it's not really having the large impact that it probably wished it had in altering the British zeitgeist. I don't think that they shouldn't exist. I don't think they should be stopped from existing because of the views that they have.
But in order for them to exist, as you said, they need to. Taking money from advertisers, right? That's their funding
model.
Yeah,
then they need to find advertisers that are happy to have their brand associated with the content that they create.
That is true. Yeah, that is true.
And actually, news, and this was a really interesting point brought up by someone who Owen Jones interviewed this weekend. News is a notoriously difficult vertical for advertisers to sell for platforms to sell advertising space against, because it is often so controversial. You don't want to have reporting of bombing in Gaza to then be followed up with a Dove advert. it doesn't look particularly good for Dove, does it? And so they've decided to have a rolling news channel that is meant to be self-sustaining through advertising, but is a notoriously very, very difficult vertical to sell advertising against. And they have incredibly low numbers as it is. And so it's no wonder that advertisers have, regardless of calls for boycotting, I don't think the boycotting calls really have anything to do with, are really affecting the companies that have pulled out. But there have been loads of companies that have pulled out.
Well, some companies have said that they want to Well, some companies said that they had bought advertising for a general service. I think the sort of ad house, if that's the right phrase, which probably isn't, is Sky. So they effectively bought like a package of advertising through Sky, and some of that advertising ended up appearing on GB News, because often in advertising, these kind of packages are, you know, they're combined out of various things. It's not like they specifically said they wanted to advertise on GB News. So some of them have now said that they want to review the content on GB News before they commit one way or the other to advertising on the channel. I guess they'll also be reviewing the audience figures, which is, you know, probably just as important to them as the content. But I think the one thing that is disingenuous about the boycotting campaigns is that they started before GB News had actually broadcast anything. And, you know, I'm sure there's lots of stuff that, you know, people will disagree with in terms of, like, panelist views on GB News and some of the views of the presenters. But I don't think I've seen anything that qualifies as hateful, even in, like, a broad sense of the word.
I would probably agree with you. But when you put the likes of, like, Andrew Neil and Tom Harwood on a lineup, you know the tone that it's probably going to end up having, don't you?
I don't know what you're saying about Dear Tom. We must get on this podcast at some point to answer these criticisms.
Not after the grilling I've just given him.
Yeah, maybe not. Shall we talk about the Education Committee's report on white working class education?
Yeah, go on then, love.
So let's do it. Do a gear shift of sorts. So this was reported, I think this was earlier in the week that it came out. And essentially what the report says is that white working class pupils, and that's generally the sort of stand-in proxy metric that is taken, is white pupils on free school meals. And to qualify for free school meals, you need a very low family income. So it says that these pupils have been failed by decades of neglect in England's education system. I'm reading a BBC summary here. And then the committee goes on to say that the government has not had enough targeted support for these pupils. And a point that Jazza actually brought out earlier, which I suppose you might as well discuss, is the criticism of terms like white privilege.
That was the thing. Sorry. I think I used a different woke phrase, but yes, you are correct.
Yeah, and the argument is that the phrase white privilege doesn't really apply to these pupils because they're so unprivileged, and also that actually the use of those sort of phrases increases kind of attitudes that contribute towards the neglect of this segment of society. Jazza, what's your take on this report in the broad?
Shall I do the white privilege thing first?
Yeah, we could start with that.
So it doesn't seem to really understand what white privilege means or how it is used. White privilege is essentially the fact that one of the characteristics of white privilege is that you don't have to think about or factor in your race in your day-to-day existence as a human being in the society in which you live. Kind of broadly, that's one of the ways that white privilege is a privilege for people who are white. When you are the majority, you are unlikely to come across any kinds of racial prejudice. There are not the same systemic barriers for you to be able to succeed that are based on your race. Having white privilege does not mean that you yourself are privileged and therefore immediately better off. Well, you're privileged in a way, but it doesn't mean that you're going to automatically always do better than everybody who is a different skin colour to you. And that seems to be the misinterpretation of that particular line in the report.
So the line in the report, just to actually get it right.
Go on, get it right, Jimmy.
Agree with the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities, and that was the recent controversial report that was relatively dismissive of the concept of institutional racism within Britain. So we agree with the Commission that current discourse around white privilege can be divisive, and we hope that by highlighting the hardships faced by many white people from disadvantaged backgrounds, our inquiry may help advance a new way to discuss disadvantage without pitting different groups against each other. That doesn't seem to be saying That, I mean,
I don't understand how it thinks that saying that people have privilege, have a certain type of privilege because they are white, pits different groups against one another.
Well, I mean, it deliberately delineates between white poorer people versus non-white poorer people, right? When you're talking about...
Because those experiences are different. I mean, this report talks about how their experiences are different, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I mean, I think that... This isn't quite what the report says, but I think that... I mean, this is something that has been argued for a while, but concerns around the disadvantages of non-white people in, you know, be it the education system, the criminal justice system, or whatnot, I think have drawn attention away from, you know, white poor people, basically, or white underprivileged people. I think that is that's a very arguable point, because, you know, societies have a certain amount of bandwidth to actually deal with issues like this. And, you know, to some degree, it's a zero sum game, right? I mean, there's stuff you can do to actually help all types of different groups of people. But when you're talking about, say, targeted support for, say, BME groups in one particular thing, that is support that will not go to white groups, even though they might be in similarly difficult situations. So if that's what's kind of meant here, and this is me very much extrapolating from what the intro to the report says, I think that's a fair point. But, yes. Just tailed off there.
What do I think about that? Disadvantages for black and brown kids that are very well documented, and the problems that they overcome and that they need to overcome need to be addressed. But there are also problems and disadvantages that people from working class backgrounds who are white kids who also experience injustice based on their socioeconomic background, and they should also be addressed. I think it's a false way of framing it, of it being a zero-sum game, that you can give money to like black kids but not to white kids. What a ridiculous...
I mean, money that you give to black white kids is by definition money you cannot give to white kids.
But you can give more. So
in that
money.
Sense, it's zero sum.
You need.
Right?
You need. You can give. No, it's not, because you can give more money. You're the government.
Yeah.
And the this is the political point scoring, Jimmy. Just you get ready. The government have decided to stop things like education maintenance allowances, things like Sure Start that are targeted towards underprivileged kids. If they really wanted to provide the kind of support that underprivileged kids need, then they could. They're the government. They can raise money and give money to those causes, for goodness sake. Like, it doesn't have to be one or the other.
Can spend more money to be... This is not a government report.
I know. You know, but I like to throw mud at them.
Yeah, but, I mean, in practice, sure, the government can spend an infinite amount of money. Like, conceptually speaking, that is true. In practice, it won't. You know, the government will actually try to balance the books to some degree. That's just an inevitable part of any kind of government's life. And in that sense, money that you spend on one thing can't be spent on another. In that sense, it is zero sum. You might, of course, argue that certain money will actually be such a good return on investment that it's worth spending it. And in that sense, you know, I guess you can say, you know, money, that sort of money spent is money earned, right? So in that sense, it isn't zero sum. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it is also that point I said about bandwidth and focus. Like, if you're focusing very much on one set of people in terms of your policies and your efforts and whatnot, you're not going to be focusing that on other groups or other problems, basically. So I think that is just true. You know, it's kind of a thing that comes up in activism a lot. It's like, oh, we should be focusing on all of these things. And it's like, well, you're probably going to have to pick one of those issues and actually focus on it, or, you know, focus a bit of attention on several of them if you prefer to do it that way. Because that's how any organization's run, right? Is that you have to deal with, you know, there's a limited amount of effort and time and money and everything else that can go into fixing problems.
Is there evidence that the government gives money to black kids more than it does to white kids. When we control for income and stuff like that.
I'm not aware that there is any evidence.
Cool.
So that is the case. So, but I think the aim of this report, one of the themes of this report is that the prospects of white poor kids have been overlooked, which is not something I don't really think that's true, to be honest. Like, I think it has been a talking point for several years.
Who has overlooked it? I don't like this report.
Well, England's education system is the particular thing. So I think actually this report purely applies to England. I think it purely applies to England rather than the UK as a whole. But one thing that is, so there's some genuinely interesting stuff here that I think comes out, and that's so this thing about, like, there's actually some quite nice graphs if you go into I know I shouldn't be describing graphs.
What direction does the line go? What colour's the line?
So this is about disparate outcomes in terms of GCSE grades from different ethnic pupils from different ethnic backgrounds. And one of the things that comes up is that Chinese pupils do particularly well. They're like the highest performing group, well above the sort of these are all like for kids on free school meals, by the way, so that level of the income of the family is somewhat accounted for. White British pupils are actually is below the average, and then you've got, as you mentioned, travellers of Irish heritage and Gypsy Roma pupils who do the worst. That to me is kind of interesting. One of the potential explanations that they lay out, there's two major ones. So you've got cultural factors, including family structure, experience of education, access to community assets such as places of worship, youth groups, and whatever. I guess they're talking about basically the level of social support and the level of support for education, and also, you know, parents' experience in education. If you've got a parent who didn't do very well in the education system, that will impact you in various ways.
There's often, if you're from an immigrant background, the importance of education is probably going to be a lot more prominent around the dinner table, for example.
Diasporic
communities that tend to support be more close-knit than maybe certain parts of traditional white working class England, where those communities have kind of been decimated since the 1980s.
Well, that's actually, this is the other, so you've got the cultural factors that you kind of touched on there. They actually talk about this thing called the immigrant paradigm, which is that thing that if you're from an immigrant background, some of them have a huge focus on education and aspiration and that sort of thing. And then you've got the other thing, which is place-based disparities, which is if you grow up in a country where the infrastructure is bad in every sense, bad job markets, lack of opportunity, etc., then you're gonna have a much more difficult time than if you grow up in a better place than that. So I think the thing is, like, this report will inevitably be interpreted around the top lines about the debate about white privilege. But there's some more basic stuff in here just about pointing out potential explanations for the disparities between different ethnic groups, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm.
I would broadly agree. It is the white privilege attack that that irks me. I think understandably irked me, because it feels like another attempt to make it a culture war issue. And I know this isn't from the government, but it certainly seems to be something that keeps on being used in the way that certain politicians and media outlets are deciding to frame a lot of their stories of wokeism being wrong. Actually, apparently, most people don't know what woke means when you poll them.
That was from a YouGov poll, wasn't it? They don't know what the word means, but I think that isn't quite the same thing as people recognizing or not recognizing the attitudes it represents.
It's like you see it with race stuff, and you see it with, like, especially the trans the way that stories around trans people are being framed in the British media at the moment as well, and it just makes me really scared and depressed.
I think we've We started on a note of Jazza's pessimism. I think it's appropriate to end on a similar sound. Jazza, where can they find you on the internet if they want to follow up in some way?
I am Jazza John, J-A-Z-Z-A, J-O-H-N, across all social media platforms, because Jimmy, I am what?
A good internet boy.
Indeed.
You can find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols, where you can tweet at me. But
the video of Matt Hancock.
Please don't do that. I've had a tough enough week as it is. I had to spend most of yesterday fixing my toilet, which broke. So.
Oh no, Jimmy. Did you have to do something like an adult?
Yeah, it was devastating, actually. I'm mostly here for the podcasting opportunities.
Poor baby.
So it's very, very difficult for me at the moment. But enough of my problems. We can wrap it up there.
Great. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.